content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Okay, let's start off with a question. Ever wondered why there's an R in MRS, Mrs.? It's pronounced Mrs. So what's with the R in MRS? We all know that spellings in English are pretty much random. The ultimate proof of this might be the word Q, where only the first letter is pronounced. It's spelled, of course, Q-U-E-U-E. The English language as we know it today is comprised of mishmash of different linguistic influences, but especially Old Norse, Old French, and Latin. On top of that, we have tons of acronym. For example, we have tons of acronym examples that have morphed into everyday words. Radar, anyone? Sonar? A consistent confusion over acronyms versus abbreviation, and a bunch of sounds that bear no resemblance to their written letters. Why do rough, cough, and though not rhyme? And what does MS stand for? Why are we content with this content? And why do you pronounce Mrs., MRS, like Mrs., which is conspicuously missing an R? Why is there an RMRS? Well, in previous centuries, the word mistress was the polite way to address all women. By the 18th century, it had been abbreviated to MRS. Since English speakers have a tendency to shorten spoken words, we soon dropped the TR, and the word became to pronounce Mrs. Similarly, men used to be called Master, which was abbreviated to MR, and soon became Mr. Interestingly, the original meaning of mistress, the title MRS, was used to address women regardless of their marital status. It didn't become a thing exclusively for married women until the late 18th century. That was when the title Miss came to mean unmarried women, instead of just young girls. And the word mistress, of course, has come to mean a different thing entirely. The thing is, the English language is always changing. Words change meaning and pronunciation, and sometimes we borrow words from other languages and make them our own. Who knows what titles we'll use for each other in the future? The only thing we can guarantee is that our grammar will continue to befuddle native speakers and English learners alike. Now, this next article is a little bit out of date because Easter was 2 days ago from when this broadcast will first be aired. But it's kind of interesting. The Easter Bunny's origins. The interesting history behind the Easter symbol, and there's a pretty picture of a bunny standing next to a colored egg that has Easter greetings on it. The Easter Bunny's history is more complicated and mysterious than you may think, and has nothing to do with the Bible. Who isn't familiar with the origin of Bugs, Thumper, or Peter Cottontail? These famous bunnies are beloved characters from classic childhood cartoons, movies, and literature. But did you ever wonder how the most famous bunny of all, the Easter Bunny, became synonymous with Easter, a holiday commemorating the resurrection of Jesus? Read on to learn how a visit from this hoppy character, who delivers Easter baskets filled with candy and other fun gifts, became a beloved Easter tradition. Easter Bunny origin. While there isn't any historical documentation that explains how a rabbit became the furry face of Easter, the most obvious connection may be the calendar. April showers not only bring spring flowers, but the birth of baby rabbits. Both springtime and bunnies are iconic symbols of birth and renewal. Rabbits, originally hares, are long-standing fertility symbols associated with the arrival of spring, because they are so prolific and give birth as soon as the weather warms, says Diane Shane Fruchtman, assistant professor of religion at Rutgers University. There's no religious significance to a bunny being part of Easter holiday, according to Dr. Fruchtman. Easter is a celebration of the resurrection of Jesus, who, according to the Gospels of Mark, Matthew, Luke, celebrated Passover on Thursday. The Last Supper was a Passover Seder, celebrating the Israelites' exodus from Egypt, was crucified on Friday, and rose from the dead on Sunday. In fact, the Easter egg has more historical context than the Easter bunny, and that eggs may have been part of the Passover Seder plate at supper, as it still is today. We don't know for sure, but later Jewish sources firmly incorporate the egg into the Passover ritual, Dr. Fruchtman says, although there are no bunnies or anywhere to be found. When did the Easter Bunny first appear? And there's a cute picture of the Easter Bunny opening a shell with a chicken inside it, and the chicken's holding flowers. That's strange. You'll see the Easter Bunny pop up, or should we say hop up, in Easter movies and on Easter decorations. but when did it actually first appear? The earliest reference to the Easter Bunny dates back to sometime before the 17th century, when the Germanic people of Europe introduced the Osterhas, a rabbit who brought gifts to children at Easter time. As History.com explains, when these Germanic immigrants settled in America in the 1700s, they brought the tradition with them to Pennsylvania. The tradition even included children leaving carrots out for the Osterhas, much like leaving cookies for Santa at Christmas. Another popular theory about the Easter Bunny. The myth of Ostara is another popular theory that some contend is the origin of the Easter Bunny. According to TheConversation.com, the 8th century scholar known as the Venerable Bede, that's B-E-D-E, wrote in his work, The Reckoning of Time, that the word Easter stems from Ostra, E-O-S-T-R-E, another version of the name Ostara, O-S-T-A-R-A. Dr. Fruchtman elaborates on this theory, saying that Bede, the English monk, wrote that the word comes from an Anglo-Saxon goddess Ostra, whose feast day in the spring coincided with the day of the Christian Paschal celebration. However, no other source mentions Ostra, and it's entirely possible that Bede made her up. But Bede makes no mention of rabbits or eggs in association with her. Where does the Easter Bunny live? Well, we all know that Santa lives at the North Pole, but the Easter Bunny's homestead is shrouded in mystery. TrackEasterBunny.com believes the Easter Bunny lives in Easter Island, a remote Polynesian island in the Pacific. Reportedly, the Easter Bunny departs from Easter Island on Easter Eve to deliver gifts and candy all across the globe. Easter Island is also said to house the magical animals who serve as the Easter Bunny's loyal helpers, similar to the elves in Santa's workshop. Why does the Easter Bunny bring eggs? There are several theories about where Easter eggs originated from and why the Easter Bunny delivers them. According to History.com, one theory contends that Easter eggs are connected to pagan traditions. The egg represented new life in the ancient world, and as such was associated with pagan spring celebrations. In Christianity, Easter eggs are said to represent Jesus' resurrection. Although the true origins of the Easter Bunny and Easter eggs may never be fully known or agreed upon, they continue to be much-loved traditions of the Easter holiday. Even if your typical Eastern sermon won't include anything about rabbit eggs or fertility, that's not to say that the Easter Bunny and Easter eggs are not religious traditions, says Dr. Fruchtman. Religion is about far more than doctrine, text, belief, and sacred buildings. It's about practices, community, memory, family, home, and traditions that have meaning to you. And so, we now know the origin of the Easter Bunny. Now, how about an inspiration article from the Reader's Digest? Growing Hope. The world's most famous living naturalist shares her reasons to feel optimistic, and it's Jane Goodall. Jane is almost 90 years old, you may think. If she is aware of what's going on in the world, how can she be writing about hope? On many days, I admit that I feel depressed these days when it seems that efforts, the struggles, and the sacrifices of so many people fighting for social and environmental justice, fighting prejudice and racism and greed, are fighting a losing battle. But without hope, all is lost. It is a crucial survivor trait that has sustained our species from the time of our Stone Age ancestors. Certainly, my own improbable journey would have been impossible had I lacked hope. Like all people who live long enough, I have been through many dark periods and seen so much suffering. I was in New York on that terrible day in 2001, that day when our world changed forever. And I can still remember the disbelief, the fear, the confusion as the city went quiet save for the wailing of the sirens on police cars and ambulance on streets emptied of people. It was 10 years after that day that I was introduced to the survivor tree, a calorie pear tree discovered a month after the collapse of the towers, crushed between two blocks of cement. All that was left was half a trunk that had been charred black, with roots that were broken and only one living branch. She was almost sent to the dump, but the young woman who found her, Rebecca Clough, begged that the tree might be given a chance. And so she went to be cared for in a nursery in the Bronx. Bringing that seriously damaged tree back to health was not an easy task, and it was touch and go for a while. But whenever you give her a chance, nature returns. And there's actually a picture here of the top of the tree in front of the new World Trade Complex. Eventually, the tree made it. Once she was strong enough, she was returned to be planted in what is now the 9/11 Memorial and Museum In the spring, her branches are bright with blossoms. I've seen people looking at her and wiping away tears. She truly is a symbol of the resilience of nature and a reminder of all that was lost on that terrible day 20 years ago. There's another, even more dramatic story about survivor trees. In 1990, I visited Nagasaki, the city where the second atomic bomb was dropped at the end of World War II. The firepower produced by the nuclear explosion reached temperatures equivalent to the sun, millions of degrees. Scientists predicted that nothing would grow for decades. But amazingly, two 500-year-old camphor trees had survived. Only the lower halves of their trunks remained, and from those, most of the branches had been torn off. Not a single leaf remained on the mutilated trees, but they were alive. I was taken to see one of the survivors. It's now a large tree, but its thick trunk has cracks and fissures, and you can see it's all black inside. But every spring, that tree puts out new leaves. Many Japanese regard it as a holy monument to peace and survival. Prayers, written in tiny kanji characters on parchment, had been hung from the branches in memory of all those who died. I stood there, humbled by the devastation we humans can cause and the unbelievable resilience of nature. What a fascinating world, the plant kingdom. And when you think about it, without flora, there would be no fauna, and there would be no humans. All animal life ultimately depends on plants. It's an amazing tapestry of life, where each little stitch is held in place by those around it. Each time a species goes extinct, it's as though a hole is torn in that wonderful tapestry of life. And in more and more places, the tapestry is so tattered that it is close to collapse. I try to make people understand how much we humans depend on the natural world. I learn from my hours in the rainforest how every species has a role to play, how everything is interconnected. Last year, on the UN International Day of Peace, I took part in a very special ceremony in New York City, along with about 20 high school children from across America. We all gathered around the survivor tree, the tree who was rescued after she was crushed and wounded in 9/11. We looked up at the strong branches reaching toward the sky. Only a short time before, they had been filled with beautiful white blossoms, and now the leaves were beginning to fall. We stood silently and prayed for peace on earth and for a new respect for animals and nature. I looked around at the young faces, the faces of those who would inherit the planet wounded by countless generations of humans. And then I saw it. I saw the neat perfection of the nest of some small bird. I imagined the parents feeding the nestlings, the fledging, the final flight into the yet as unknown world. The children were also staring up at the nest. Some smiled. Others had tears in their eyes. They, too, were ready to move out into the world. The survivor tree brought back from the dead had not only put out new leaves herself, but also nurtured the lives of others. Now, do you understand how I dare hope? Now an article of national interest. Where have all the nurses gone? The next healthcare crisis could prove disastrous for patients and rural hospitals. Sometimes Carla Thielen just wishes she could explain, that she could plop herself down by her patient's bedside, look him in the eye, and explain that she does care and is not ignoring him. That you just had to intubate a guy down the hall, and the woman next door fell on the way to the bathroom. That she has 4 missed calls on her cell phone from another patient's daughter, who just learned her dad is dying. That she hadn't eaten all day and had time to use the bathroom. But Thielen, who as a traveling or contract nurse has worked in more than 30 hospitals across America and West over the past decade, knows she can't do that. It wouldn't be professional or compassionate to walk into a room and tell a patient that the hospital is woefully understaffed, that she has more on her plate than any one nurse could possibly handle, that this is why I'm late, I had to deal with this situation, that COVID-19 has pushed a system already created by chronic staffing shortages to the brink. So she stays quiet and plows ahead. At the end of the toughest day, she sits alone and asks herself the same question many nurses are asking themselves nowadays. How much longer can I keep this up? Thielen, who lives in rural Montana, got into nursing in 2009. She says, so she could help people navigate the most uncertain and frightening times of their lives. Caring for someone stripped down to those vulnerable places of actual suffering, Thielen says, makes her feel more human, resets her, and makes her life feel meaningful. You're connecting on a very elemental level, she says. For me, it has always brought me back to the real essence of what it is to be human. It's vital to my existence. But lately, the job and the feeling that she is failing her patients has become unbearable. It's not being asked to work hard, she says. It's asked to do something that's impossible with a 12-hour shift. The fact is, in America today, there simply aren't enough nurses. Those who have stayed on the job are being asked to care for more patients than is safe both the nurses and the patients. In September, the American Nurses Association, the ANA, which represents the nation's 4.2 million registered nurses, sent a letter to Secretary of Health and Human Services Xavier Becerra, calling on him to declare a current unsustainable nurse staffing shortage facing our country, a national crisis. As ANA President Ernest Grant explained in a news blast to the media, the nation's health care delivery systems are overwhelmed and nurses are tired and frustrated. It was brewing before COVID. Even before the pandemic, burnout was bleeding the nursing field of some of its most promising talent. Of the more than 418,000 registered nurses who quit their jobs in 2017, 3 years before COVID hit, more than 30% cited stressful work environments and inadequate staffing. By December 2020, at COVID's height, 60% of the nurses surveyed said they suffered from burnout, and a survey in early 2021 indicated that 30% considered quitting their jobs or leaving their profession altogether. These departures added to a shortfall that has been brewing for decades, one that is only expected to get worse. By 2030, more than a quarter of the nation's roughly 4 million registered nurses will likely retire. This at a time when transformations in the field of health care and an explosion in the nation's elderly population will require a net increase of an estimated 500,000 new positions. In that sense, COVID simply provided a glimpse of the worst-case scenario, a preview of what we can expect should we fail to head off the impending crises. In Texas, hospitals are staring down 23,000 unfilled registered nursing jobs, prompting state officials to launch an effort to recruit 2,500 nurses from outside the state. Louisiana had more than 6,000 vacant nursing positions even before the Delta variant hit. Mississippi has lost 2,000 nurses since the pandemic began, while hospitals in Tennessee are down 1,000 staffers. In Georgia and Oregon, the situation became so extreme that officials were forced to mobilize the National Guard to assist in hospitals. In small rural hospitals, particularly in the South and West, the situation has been catastrophic. Tyler Williams, president and CEO of Habersham Medical Center, a 53-bed hospital in Demarest, Georgia, says the nursing crisis had already begun to affect his institution prior to COVID. For years, his hospital has hired nurses fresh out of nursing school to staff its ranks, offering the opportunity for entry-level training in lieu of the higher salaries seen at larger institutions. But around 2018, the larger facilities began hiring nurses just out of school, too, paying an additional $3 an hour. And, since the pandemic began, Williams has had lost a fifth of his nursing staff, as those bigger hospitals have been luring them away by doubling their hourly rates and offering significant signing bonuses as large as $30,000. There's just a shortage all around, Williams says. We can't keep up with that. The end result? Americans are likely to see higher medical costs as well as increased financial strain on smaller rural hospitals, which could lead to a reduction in the number of available beds. This is the perfect storm, warns Rhonda Manville, Executive Associate Dean for Academic Nursing at Pace University in New York. The nursing shortage is here, and it's going to continue to grow and become more acute, leaving people in our communities without enough trained professionals to meet their health care needs. A cascading problem. Public health officials have been warning for years that the United States is facing a demographic time bomb, what some have called a gray tsunami. By 2030, every single member of the baby generation, estimated to be at 73 million strong, will have reached retirement age, more than doubling the number of Americans over age of 65 at the dawn of the millennium. These elderly adults are going to need a lot of health care, much of it complex. Meanwhile, the average age of American nurses has risen to 51, and the anticipated retirement of 1 million nurses comes at a time when the health care system is in the midst of a transformation that will require more nurses to face that gray tsunami. The positive news is that many young Americans want to become nurses. Indeed, enrollment in nursing programs has been growing every year for the past 15 years. And today, the United States is graduating more nurses than at any point in history, with nursing schools having to double their output over the past 15 to 20 years. And for good reason. The average starting salary for a registered nurse straight out of college is $55,000. Here's the catch. There aren't enough nursing schools to educate enough students to fill the projected 1.5 million nursing slots that will need to be filled by 2030. In 2020, a total of 80,521 qualified applications were not accepted at schools of nursing, primarily because of the shortage of faculty, classroom space, and clinical sites, which gives student nurses much-needed real-life experience outside of the classroom. It's a complex problem, says Pace Manevo. We're not educating enough nurses in the baccalaureate level, and even if we did, we don't have enough faculty in graduate programs because it's not an attractive career. Many nursing schools are turning to adjunct instructors whose average starting salary is only $8,000. The educational bottlenecks are just one cause of the nursing shortage. Linda Aching, who heads the University of Pennsylvania Center for Health Outcomes and Policy Research, says burnout is a far greater factor. She notes that about a third of all nurses are not working full-time, and she blames working conditions. Incentives in the marketplace could easily pull more nurses in, Aiken says. Nurses are very responsible to market incentives, such as better compensation and flexible hours. Yet instead of trying to lure nurses, she argues, many hospitals are driving them away by cutting corners, either in the number of nurses on shift or in the support personnel who would allow units to move smoothly. How bad is it? In one pre-COVID study, Aiken and her colleagues surveyed most of the registered nurses in New York State, asking them how many patients they had taken care of the previous day. She found that more than 40% of the hospitals were understaffed, which are defined as nurses caring for more than 4 patients. Some are taking care of more than 10. Such low nurse-to-patient ratios leads to burnout. In the 2 months prior to the 2020 pandemic surge, Aiken found that 50% of the nurses in New York State Hospital were already experiencing high levels of stress because there weren't enough nurses and support staff to shoulder the load. But more than being a morale buster, low ratios can also be dangerous. The most important thing nurses do in a hospital is act as a surveillance system, which means they are trying to project who's going to develop a complication before it happens. When a patient is in distress, it's often the nurse who is the first to notice, sound the alarm, and call in others to save a life. But if you don't have enough nurses, you have no surveillance system. So you identify impending problems early enough to correct them, she says. She cites one study that looked at more than 74,000 Medicare patients who suffered from common conditions such as congestive heart failure, pneumonia, strokes, and infections. They discovered that patients in understaffed facilities had higher mortality rates and higher readmission rates and were more likely to suffer from sepsis and infections than patients in fully staffed hospitals. Of course, nurses do more than heal the body. Carla Thielen has found that in well-staffed hospitals, she has plenty of time to assess patients thoroughly, attend their personal hygiene, check their vital signs, including washing their hair and brushing their teeth, and change bed linens. More importantly, she has time to connect with patients. Over the years, patients have confessed to love affairs, talked about the children they had given up for adoption, and confided that they always wanted to be a painter, or that they had regretted not having kids. Others just looked her in the eyes and told her, "What I know now is what's really important. Now, time to connect with patients is a luxury." What's the solution? A fix won't be easy, but in its letter to Health and Human Services, the American Nursing Association called on the agency to convene stakeholders to identify short- and long-term solutions to staffing challenges. Such solutions would include payment equity for nursing services, presumably as a way of overcoming geographic disparity in pay that are likely to hit rural hospitals in the South and West harder than others. Many have suggested that federal government expand programs that provide aid to nursing schools in the hope of luring more faculty. Others would like to see mandatory nurse-to-patient ratios to lessen burnout. California is the only state that currently has them. But all of these solutions will require money. Whether the political will exists to appropriate the extra money to implement these solutions or to impose new requirements on hospitals remains an open question. At its core, nursing is about relationships. Thielen and her colleagues recognize that work conditions aren't likely to get easier anytime soon. even though, so for now, she has no plans to leave the profession. Though serving as a face of healthcare system that is failing to meet the needs of patients is a painful reality, Thielen still has glimpses of why she loves her job. Recently, she sat with a COVID patient who had been intubated for 3 weeks and had awakened to learn that during his time in a medically induced coma, his house had burned down, killing his beloved dog. Thielen found him lying awake in the middle of the night. She quietly shut the door to his room and sat by his bed as he wept. "It's the shared moments when you have the time," she says. "All of a sudden you're in the moment with somebody, taking care of their needs, helping them. You don't think about what their politics are. You do think about how they're dressed, where they work, how much money they have. Working as a nurse is a beating, such a beating, yet I'm compelled to do it because of those moments that are so good and so rich." And there's a picture of Carla Thielen. Her hair is kind of a mess. She's wearing glasses. She's got a stethoscope. But she looked very serious. And with that rather depressing article, let's switch over to Consumer Reports. And last week we were reading about how to safety your home. And we got through several rooms. Let's see what we got through. Let me turn the page here. Got through the bathroom and the laundry room. And also we got through smoke and carbon monoxide detectors. But let's take a look at the bedroom. Ideally, your bedroom is your safe haven, where you can escape life stressors, and it can be. And it can be. These tips will help you sleep more safely and soundly. Secure furniture. That means attaching heavy furniture, think dressers, bookcases, and jumbo-sized TVs, to the wall, particularly in kids' rooms. Each year from 2017 through 2019, an average of 19,900 people went to ERs for injury related to furniture tip-overs. And between 2000 and 2019, 351 people were reported killed in tip-over incidents, according to the CPSC. And it's not just young children. More than 11,000 adults are injured each year by tip-overs. Even expensive and seemingly well-made dressers can tip, especially when a drawer is open or a TV is on top. Yet one of the CR's 2021 surveys, less than a third of Americans said they anchor any of their furniture. So keep your furniture and TV stable. Here's how. When purchasing new dressers, check CR's test to identify stable ones. Anchor dressers to studs in your wall using anti-tip kits that come with the product or standalone kits you buy separately. Never use drywall anchors or toggles. They pull out too easily. On the furniture, attach the brackets as high as you can, preferably into solid wood. For TVs, use a wall mount when possible if setting to put this set on top of a dresser or another piece of furniture. If you can't mount the TV on a wall, make sure the piece of furniture it is on is stable and large enough to support a TV and anchor it as you would a dresser. Space heater rules. About 17,000 house fires and 80 deaths are tied to portable space heaters annually. Here are some tips for safe use. Place the space heaters on hard, level, non-flammable flooring. Don't use in a child's room or never leave one unattended. Keep them at least 3 feet away from bedding, curtains, and other combustible materials. Check cords for damage. Don't use with extension cords. And consider an arc fault circuit interrupter outlets or circuit breakers. They prevent fires on appliances that draw heavy current, cause an electric arc, or overheat loose connections. A safe and cozy nursery. As a mom who also writes about product safety, my new parent friends are maybe just a little tired of hearing my repeated warnings about all the products they need to watch out for in their infants' nurseries. And it's true. The standard advice, babies should be put to bed on their backs and a firm, flat surface free of soft bedding, can sound cold. But here's also, I also want my friends to know you don't have to sacrifice comfort to create a safe sleep space. You just need to think creatively about how to achieve it. Here are some ideas. Instead of a loose blanket in your infant's crib, go with sleep sacks or swaddles. Any soft bedding is a no-no because it increases the risk of suffocation. But to keep your baby warm overnight and during naps, in a cuddly sleep sack, which is a kind of wearable blanket, that has the extra benefit of being something your baby can't kick off. You can also wrap your newborn in a swaddle, essentially a small blanket wrapped and tucked in around your baby. That stimulates the snug environment of the womb and can help babies sleep more soundly. To swaddle safely, leave legs and hips loose so your baby can stretch, and stop swaddling when they begin to try to roll over, typically around 2 months. Instead of pillow toys and padded bumpers in the crib, go with mobile-type toys. Pillows of any type, even those marketed to treat minor flathead syndrome, can be a hazard. But it's okay to have toys suspended above your baby's crib as long as they're out of reach. And, of course, go ahead and make the rest of the baby's room cozy with embroidered pillows, soft toys, or stuffed animals, as long as they are out of reach. Instead of bed sharing, go with room sharing. You don't have an infant in bed with you, except for nursing or comfort. But it's a good idea to keep the baby's crib, bassinet, portable crib, or a play yard in your bedroom, close to your bed. That cuts the risk of sudden infant death syndrome by as much as 50%, according to the American Academy of Pediatrics, and will make it easier for you to feed, comfort, and watch your baby. Instead of an inclined sleeper, go with a bouncy seat. Inclined sleepers, tiny hammock-like beds for infants, were essentially banned by the CPSC in June 2021 after they were linked to numerous infant deaths, but it's still fine to use a bouncy seat. That's a similar-looking product, but is meant to be used when the baby is awake and being supervised. If the baby begins to nod off on the seat, move them to a crib, bassinet, or a play yard. How about outdoors? Life in our backyards is supposed to be safe, but the tools we use to keep our yards tidy cause thousands of injuries and dozens of fatalities each year, and the pandemic means that more of us are using that equipment, some for the first time. Proper use means more than just limiting kids' access to powerful machines such as riding lawnmowers. It also means taking the right safety steps with proper heaters and chimneys, portable fire pits with a chimney, now shown in so many patios and decks. Warm up safely. Fire pits. Whether you get around a portable fire pit, a built-in fireplace, a chimney, or a simple hole in the ground ringed with stones, the fire should ideally be at least 20 feet from your house or other structures such as garages and fences. Don't put them under tree limbs or electrical wires either. When the fire is done, spread out as many coals and unburnt logs as thinly as possible and douse with a hose set to a wide spread till the embers go out. Propane heaters. It can be easy to think that these stand-up heaters, now common in outdoor restaurants and patios alike, pose little danger, but their heating elements get red hot and can burn skin or ignite flammable materials that touch the heater, such as a windblown paper napkin or clothing. And never use gas-burning models indoors. As with generators, they produce carbon monoxide. Make sure you put them on a flat, solid, non-combustible surface so they don't tip over or spread fire if they do. How to run a portable generator? Don't use one in the garage or basement or in a semi-enclosed area such as a porch. These machines emit carbon monoxide. The CPSC estimates that each year more than 700 people die of carbon monoxide poisoning while using portable generators. Yet 20% of owners say they typically use their portable generator in a shed, in a garage, or indoors, according to one of CR's 2021 surveys. Take these steps to avoid carbon monoxide poisoning while using a generator. Place the generator at least 20 feet from your home. Always direct exhaust away from your home. Choose one that shuts off automatically if CO builds to a dangerous level. Look for terms such as CO Guard, CO Protect, CO Detect, CO Shield, or CO Sense on the label. Make sure it meets one of these two voluntary standards, ANSI/UL 2021 Certified for Carbon Monoxide Safety, or ANSI/PGMA G300 Certified Safety and Performance. Mow carefully. Injuries related to riding lawnmowers sent an average of 33,000 people to the emergency room each year between 2018 and 2020, according to the CPSC. Here's how to prevent those injuries. Boy, I can remember almost rolling my tractor when I was mowing. Read the instructions. It's important to understand how to use all the mower's controls before you hop on. Check terrain, looking especially for bumps, steep slopes, large holes, and rocks, all of which can overturn a machine. Don't mow wet grass, which can cause you to lose traction and control. Protect your feet. That means never trying to stabilize the machine by putting your feet on the ground and wearing studio shoes with laces shoes with laces tied tight. Practice good gas hygiene. Never remove the gas cap or add fuel while the engine is running, and let the engine cool before refueling. Don't refuel it indoors or in the garage. Don't miss out. Pay now or else. Great deals here. Get hired today. Past due. Surefire investment. Congratulations, you're a winner. how to protect yourself. Scams are on the rise. Fraudsters are everywhere, targeting us by text, email, Facebook, and more. What to know now? When Angela Chavez, a 30-year-old fashion illustrator in Los Angeles, met Ouija, a local businessman on a dating app last fall, she was delighted to find that they had many interests in common, including entrepreneurship and music. The two began sharing photos and texting multiple times daily through WhatsApp. We were so alike, and he was so kind and interested in talking about our daily lives, Chavez says. When Ouija casually mentioned that he was investing in cryptocurrency, a digital-only form of currency whose value tends to be volatile, when Chavez expressed interest, he offered to help her to get into the market too. With both trepidation and excitement, she purchased the cryptocurrency Ethereum through an app Ouija recommended her. An investment of a few $100 appeared to nearly double in value within minutes, allaying any fears she had about the digital marketplace. When I saw that, I thought, okay, this is real, Chavez said. She continued adding to her portfolio over the next several weeks, but she was becoming frustrated with her virtual dating relationship. Every time she and Ouija discussed meeting in person, he canceled with an excuse. After a month, she told Ouija that she'd drop him if they didn't meet. Shortly after that, he stopped responding to her text, and her cryptocurrency account balance, about $20,000, vanished. I realized I had ignored a lot of red flags because he got me to trust him, she says. Like Chavez, a growing number of Americans are falling victims of scams. The first three quarters of 2021 saw 2.1 million reports of fraud, putting it on a par with all of 2020, according to the Federal Trade Commission. And in November 2021, nationally represented consumer reports of 2,057 Americans adults, 95% say had received communication in the past 30 days that they believed to be fraudulent. Nearly half of Americans reported getting six or more phony messages in a typical week. I get about three a day. The pandemic and all the time people have been spending online, where scammers can target them by text, email, and social media, likely plays a role. In addition, the scam landscape has changed, with international criminal organizations increasingly in the mix, says Kathy Stokes, Director of Fraud Prevention Programs at AARP. They've got offices and employees and lead lists that they buy off other scammers. But no matter how sophisticated scammers are, there's plenty you can do to help protect yourself. Here, how to spot some top scams, what to do if you've been targeted, and how to avoid fraudsters in the future. The imposter scam. You owe us money. Someone from the IRS or other important-sounding government agency or business calls to alert you to a problem. You owe thousands of dollars in back taxes, a fine from Social Security, or an unpaid debt to a business. The caller may have your bank account data or a partial Social Security number, making them seem more credible. You're also told that you must pay up right away or have your financial accounts frozen or face arrest. The caller directs you to use an unusual payment method, often a gift card. To avoid trouble, you follow the instructions to buy a gift card and give the caller the number on the back. The card is immediately drained of value by the scammer. Warning signs. Government employees never call consumers about money owed or threaten arrest. Neither a government agency nor a legitimate business would request immediate payment by gift card. For back tax payments, for instance, the IRS would notify you by mail and have you pay by check or credit card via mail or its secured online site. What to do? Hang up. If you already followed the caller's instructions, that gift card money is likely gone. It's the same as paying someone with cash, Stokes says, but the FTC recommends notifying the gift card issuer right away. Also report the theft to the police in case you can claim losses on your homeowner's insurance or tax return. File a complaint at reportfraud.ftc.gov to help agencies track the scammers. Best practices, always contact a government agency or business directly if you receive any unexpected calls, texts, emails, or other communication. The online shopping scam. Awesome deals here. Scrolling through Facebook or Instagram, you spot an ad for a cordless drill you've been searching for. Your click leads you to a website where you buy the tool, perhaps with a credit card or by using a debit card or peer-to-peer payment app like Zelle. These days, you're likely to see ads on social media or Google for everything from drills to designer clothes to cars, even puppies up for adoption. But a growing number of online shoppers aren't getting what they paid for, a Better Business Bureau BBB study found. In your case, perhaps no drill arrives, Well, when your package does appear, it contains a poor quality tool or something entirely different, like a ruler. While the last example may seem puzzling, it's increasingly common, says Bill Kress, an associate professor of accounting at Governor State University in University Park, Illinois. Some sales platforms, like Facebook Marketplace, release your payment to the seller once a package delivery is confirmed, even if the item inside isn't what you ordered. Then the bad guys disappear into the ozone with your money, Kress says. Warning signs: no refund policy, phone number, or address is clearly listed. Watch for business emails with Yahoo or Gmail addresses. Excuse me, got to turn a page. A lot of negative reviews. What to do? If you pay by credit card, ask the representative how to get your money back. With some of the payment methods, it may be an iffier. Report the theft to the platform you bought the item on, and to keep scrutiny on scammers, to reportfraud.ftc.gov and bbb.org/scammertracker. Best practices. Instead of clicking on links in online ads, go to the retailer websites directly, Kress says. You can't be sure where links will take you. When shopping online, try to pay with a credit card, which offers the strongest protection. Keep a record and screenshots of purchases. The employment scam. A great job awaits. While job hunting, you may see positions like mystery shopper, shipping warehouse or worker, or remote assistant on social media and employment websites like Indeed.com. That online platform was one of the most often cited for employment scams in 2020 BBB report. But a stranger may also reach out to you about a job by text or email. Applications may ask for your Social Security and financial account numbers. Once you're hired, usually in a lightning-fast process, your new boss asks for what may be thousands of dollars for work supplies or training, then disappears. Or right after sending your first paycheck, the employer asks for some of the money back, saying you've been overpaid accidentally. Once you return it, your paycheck bounces, leaving you on the hook for the money you sent, plus a bounce check fee. And the job scammer may also use your information to steal from you. Warning signs. Hiring applications shouldn't ask for Social Security or bank account numbers, nor should employers ask you to pay for training or work supplies, or request that you refund them part of a check they've sent you. What to do? If you shared personal data like your financial account numbers, freeze your credit and charge account passwords right away, says Eva Velasquez, CEO of the nonprofit Identify Theft Resource Center. IdentifyTheft.gov has step-by-step identity protection plans. Ask your bank to either flag or close the account and reverse the transaction if you've lost money. Best practices. Be wary of applying for shipping, warehouse, or mystery shopper work, and jobs that have vague descriptions or offer work from home or flexible opportunities, such as on-the-spot offers, the BBCB says. Check to see if a job is actually listed on the company website and search online for the company's name plus reviews, complaints, or scam. The investment scam. Big profits, low risk. You get a call from an investment advisor or broker with a can't-miss opportunity. It may be someone in your orbit, a member of your church, a virtual acquaintance from a Facebook group, or a complete stranger. You're told to get in on the investment, you need to send money through a peer-to-peer payment app like Cash App or Venmo, a wire transfer, a gift card, or cryptocurrency, as Angelica Chavez was told. But that surefire investment turns out to be phony, and because the payment method you were urged to use is hard to track, your money is gone. Warning signs. Being pitched through a cold call is always suspect, Stokes says, but no matter who approaches you, if you're asked to invest through a payment app, wire transfer, gift card, or cryptocurrency, it's a strong indication that the opportunity is bogus. Being rushed and the promise of huge profits and low risk also are red flags. What to do? If you lost money through an investment scam, you're unlikely to get it back, but you can probably claim a loss on your taxes, and it's wise to report the theft to the payment platform that you used and to your local police department. Also, file a complaint with the Securities and Exchange Commission. That's sec.gov/OEIA/complaint.html. The Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, FINRA, FINRA.org/investors/need-help/file-a-complaint, and report fraud, FTC.gov, which tracks patterns of complaints. Even if you know the person offering the deal, check their professional background first. Scammers are far less likely to have legitimate credentials. Go to investment.gov to find out if an investment advisor is registered or licensed or has a history of disciplinary actions. Do the same for the brokers at brokercheckfinra.org, and always pay for investments in easy-to-track ways. The sweepstakes scam, you're a winner! To get a text, email, or call saying you've won an iPad, gift card, or a new car, the message was made appear to be from a government lottery or sweepstakes or a well-known firm, think Publishers Clearing House, tells you that you need to pay a handling charge or taxes on your winnings up front. Or maybe it says you're only a potential winner, but a small fee will boost your shot at the prize. The sponsor asks for credit card numbers to cover those calls and possibly for your bank account info in order to send your winnings. Try to persuade you to ante up. They even deposit a small check into your account. You hand over your credit card info to pay the fees. Your card is charged, the check bounces, and the scammer drops out of sight. Warning signs. Do you remember entering that sweepstakes? Even if you do, legitimate sponsors will ask for money or account information. What to do? Contact your bank and credit card company. Depending on the type of transaction, it's sometimes possible to get your money back. Report losses to the police at reportfraud.ftc.gov and file a complaint or identify theft.gov. If you gave the scammer personal info, for mail scams, notify the United States Postal Inspection Service, USPIS.gov. Best practices. If you really think you may have won a prize, reach out directly to the sponsoring organization, not to email or phone numbers the scammer provided. Online search for the organizations by name along with like, review, complaint, and scam. I get almost daily things like, hi, this is an email. Hi, this is Costco. We would like to reward our members with a gift card, except I'm not a member. So we get all those all the time. You really got to be careful about that. Four ways to prevent a scam. One, trust your gut. Scammers often urge you to act immediately or to take some time to think about the message or offer you've gotten before acting on it. You may be able to sidestep a scam. Number two, don't respond. Ignore calls, texts, and email if you're unsure about who the sender or caller is. It's better, for instance, to simply let an unexpected phone call go to voicemail. Also, if you generally rely on caller ID, be aware that it can be falsified. And never give your personal or financial to anyone who contacts you out of the blue. If you think that a message might have merit, get in touch with the organization yourself in a way you're sure that's legitimate. Check before you click. Don't click on links in emails and text if you have any uncertainty. Some may put your device's security in jeopardy. Hovering your mouse over a link in an email will reveal the entire URL, which may help you determine if it's fraudulent. Case in point, an .ru at the end of a URL means the link you thought was a local retailer was created in Russia. Pay wisely. With peer-to-peer payment methods like Cash App, Venmo, and Zelle, for instance, it's best to use them only with people you know, says Bill Kress, a fraud expert. Also, don't send money to anyone who sends you an unsolicited check, even if the funds appear in your account, says Stephen Baker, an international investigation specialist for the Better Business Bureau. It may take weeks for a bank to realize a check is fake, which may put you in a dicey position. Your Field Guide to Common Cons. The scams out there may differ widely, but they share at least one trait, trying to separate you from your money and or personal information. The folks behind the frauds also have similarities. Scammers are very good at building trust, says Eva Velasquez, president and CEO of the Identity Theft Resource Center, and know how to create a sense of urgency. This quick take can help you head off trouble. The imposter scam. Contacts you by telephone or email. The median loss has been $850. The lowdown. This was 2020's most common fraud strategy. Criminal poses as a government official or company representative says there's a problem with your account, often that you owe money, wants the money ASAP, and may want personal info too. Most victims were age 50 and older. Warning signs. Unexpected call from someone who claims to be from a government agency. Regress from a supposed government business rep for money in hard-to-trace ways like gift cards. The online shopping scam. Contacts you by social media websites. Median loss is only $100, but it's still a loss. Scammer advertises great deals on enticing products such as designer handbags, furniture, cars, and even adoptable pets. Or may offer scam items such as a COVID-19 test kits. Never delivers once you've paid. Often it serves people 50 and younger. often has no clear refund policy, physical address, or phone number listed, has a disproportionately high number of negative reviews, business emails with Yahoo or Gmail addresses. The employment scam contacts you by email, social media, job websites, radio, and TV. The median loss is almost $2,000. Scammer offer impersonates employer and hires you and often sends a paycheck, then asks you to return money claiming they overpaid. The paycheck bounces. He may steal your identity, too, or ask you to pay for work supplies and disappear. In 2020, more commonly reported losses by people under 40. Warning signs. Application asks for personal financial information and or social security number. Vague job descriptions, positions that promise work from home, flexible hours, overly fast or easy hiring process. The investment scam contacts you by online ads, social media, or telephone. Median loss here was $1,560. Scammer touts a no-fail investment or insider secrets that will yield big profits, and then urges you to send money right away, then disappears with your funds. Targets people aged 20 to 49. High-pressure sales pitches with urgency about acting fast. Guarantees that you'll make money. Request payment in an unusual form like cryptocurrency or wire transfer. The sweepstakes scam contacts you by email, letter, social media, telephone, text. Median loss is $1,000. Scammer says you won a prize and requests a fee, maybe for taxes on what you've won, and or bank information to claim it, then steals that fee or raids your account. In 2020, more commonly reported by people over 50. And the warning signs, being asked to shell out money or provide personal information to get your winnings, or in some cases, increase your odds of winning. Pressure is to act now. CR's Ultimate Stain Removal Guide. And there's a picture here of a table with a whole bunch of food on it, including spaghetti and meatballs, a salad with dressing with oil, a bottle of wine, and the bottle of wine is tipped over, staining the tablecloth. The spaghetti has been pulled off, falling on the floor. The wine has dripped down onto a damask-covered chair. The oil from the salad has spilled onto the table as well and stained the tablecloth. Looks like a good time. It's a common scenario. You're enjoying wearing your favorite shirt or sinking into a comfy armchair when suddenly the mustard squeeze bottle misfires or your coffee cup takes a flight and makes one heck of a mess. While you can't hit the rewind button, if you act quickly and appropriately, the splatters may not have a fighting chance, says Caitlin Swatko, president of the Consumer Textile Information Resource Fabric Link. To help you keep your home and clothes stain-free, we've gathered the smartest, simplest stain removal advice and tools to tackle common offenders. First, some ground rules. Take care of any mess ASAP. The sooner you treat it, the easier it will be to remove. Many stains benefit from blotting. Use plain white paper towels or a clean white cloth, cotton or microfiber, and dry, unless otherwise noted, to dab up messes. Blot from the edges of the spill toward the center. Do the reverse and you may actually spread the stain. Be very sparing with water. Working on upholstery fabrics to avoid ending up with a water ring stain. Check tags and labels for laundering information. Dry clean only means the washer may ruin the fabric or trim. After using a retreat product on an item, it's okay to launder with other items. Check drying bleach. Check that the other fabrics are color fast. If in doubt, wash the stained item separately. When color fastness is a concern, test your cleaner with a cotton swab in a small, unnoticeable area first. On hard surfaces such as stone countertops, use a non-abrasive scrubbing pad. Steel wool will scratch. Don't toss an item in the dryer until the stain is gone. Heat may lock it in. Just a warning, we aren't going to get through all of these, so we'll finish up next week with the rest. But anyway, let's go with coffee, tea, and wine. These beverages started as plants and get their stain power from vegetable dyes. If washable fabrics, work from the back of the fabric, flushing with cold water, then apply an enzymatic laundry pre-treat. And there's a thing on that we'll talk about later. Rub a little laundry detergent into the stain and launder using the warmest water the label recommends. Repeat until the stain disappears. Upholstery. Blot like crazy. Then splash with carbonated water. Blot and repeat. No luck. Dampen with water. Apply detergent solution. And work it in with a clean sponge and blot. Repeat until clean. Dab with water to remove detergent and blot. Leather. Blot with tamp cloth as soon as possible. Carpet. Blot well, mix 4 cups of water, a tablespoon of dish soap, and 1/4 cup of white vinegar, and apply with a clean sponge, soaking the spot. After 5 to 10 minutes, blot again with a clean cloth. Natural stone countertops, such as granite and marble, but not non-porous quartz. Make a paste of baking soda and hydrogen peroxide, says Lenny Scarino, president, CEO, and co-founder of Grounder Gold. Granite Gold, a stone and quartz care company. Cover the spot and let it sit for several hours. Non-wood flooring. Rub gently with scouring powder and a cloth, damp it in hot water, or dab with 3% hydrogen peroxide. Ketchup tomato sauce. These foods are often doubly challenged, says Swantke, because tomato's red pigment acts as a dye, and any oil, fin, say pasta sauce, tends to saturate and stick in fabric fibers. A carpet. Blot or scrape with a butter knife to remove the excess, then saturate the stain with ammonia solution. 1 tablespoon of clear household ammonia to 1/8 cup of water from a spray bottle. Blot well. Next, apply a bit of a detergent. Blot well. Spritz the area with water and blot. Spray it again, then cover with a pad of paper cloth towels under a weight to dry. Got a brick? It's perfect. Washable fabrics. Saturate the 80 with an enzymatic laundry pretreatment and wait a few minutes. If it's a large stain, rub the liquid laundry detergent, then wash in cold water. In upholstery, blot to remove excess, wet fabric with a small amount of water, soak for 1 minute, and blot with a paper towel. Repeat until the stain is gone. Blot dry, stain still there, dampen the area using a sponge, work a small amount of detergent solution on face and into the stain, and blot until it's gone. Leather. This is the tricky one. You can try the same approach as for mustard, or ask your furniture dealer to try a cleaner for advice. And we'll do mustard next week because we're almost out of time. You just blah, blah, blah all day. Working from home gave America's children a glimpse of how their parents make a living. Here's how some of the youngest describe it. Claire, 5. She does grown-up homework. She works for cookies. The parent's occupation is the owner of a baking company. Celia, 6. She works for sales. She says sales, and they say blah, 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 blah. Parent's occupation, strategic account director. Cass, age 6. My dad peaches when people should become members in something. Both of them can't work at the same time. We only have one work closet. Parent's occupation, associate professor of business economics. And here's an interesting quote from Chris Rock, who's been in the mail. Always eat before a meeting, even a lunch meeting, because hungry people say things we regret. Some people feel confusion and uncertainty, which often things that arrive right before possibility, and do nothing, don't do nothing. Alice Dimitrov, a poet. And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Bye.